disturb the scholarly researches of the entire library staff.
But please, Suck the Crystal said quickly, it was an entry in the table that suddenly cross-correlated with some new plates that I helped prepare and catalog just this turn. A few milliseconds ago, over at the comm input, I had prepared the crystal plates from the turn's batch of data transmitted by the humans, and had proof-tasted them carefully with the vibrations from the acoustic delay line, as any apprentice should. Now, most of the apprentices don't really care what is on the plates, just as long as they agree with the delay line vibrations. But I like to taste them and do preliminary correlations, and pretend that I am the keeper of the comm.
You? Seek the Sky shuffled. Keeper of the comm?
Well, said Suck the Crystal, yes. He hastened to explain himself. Heaven's Bounty has been keeper of the comm for more than 15 human minutes. There may be other apprentices who are older than I, but I'm the only one who really cares about the information we are collecting. I bet when the council meets to replace Heaven's Bounty, they will choose me. Am I right? You're on the council.
Seek the Sky said. Maybe you are right. But don't let it make you spread. Now, what is this correlation that has your edges flapping?
The large veil-like nebula that is fifth on the list can be extrapolated back to a point of origin at a certain time about 500,000 human years ago. That point is very close to here, about 50 light-years away. That point in space and time is also almost exactly on the path that Egg is on, if you extrapolate back along its track.
Very interesting, the chief librarian said. You have probably identified the time and place of the supernova explosion that formed Egg.
But what is more interesting, continued Suck the Crystal, is that the climatological records that are coming down right now indicate a very drastic change of climate on the humans' Earth at about that time. Also, that time corresponds with the human anthropologist's estimate for the genesis of the Homo sapiens species. I believe that the laying of Egg by a supernova explosion so very near the solar system was the direct cause of the emergence of intelligence in the creatures that now float above us, teaching us all they know.
I am sure the humans will be amused when they hear that, Seek the Sky said. Let us go see Heaven's Bounty, and have her put that in her next message.
Time, 14:20 and 5 seconds, GMT. Monday, 20 June, 2050. Jean was busy setting up an alternate communication link with the infrared scanner when she heard a loud, snorting bark. It sounded like an angry seal. She quickly turned, looking for the source of the noise.
I fell asleep and snored, said an abashed Pierre, who had been handing her tools while she was head downwards inside the infrared scanner bay.
No wonder,
she replied, pulling herself out of the bay and taking the toolkit from him.
You missed your sleep shift when this ruckus started.
You head off to your rack and get some sleep. You are no good to us in this condition.
But if I go to sleep for 8 hours, there will be 1,000 years of Chila development before I wake up. That is like sleeping through the rise and fall of the Roman Empire.
Set your alarm for 6 hours,
she replied, pushing him down the passageway.
That will give you enough sleep to keep you going, and maybe you will be awake again before they develop spaceflight.
Time, 14:28 and 11 seconds, GMT. Monday, 20 June, 2050. Soother's worry paused in the middle of his message to the human. He formed a manipulator, grew a crystalline bone to strengthen it, and pressed the panels that turned off the image that was beaming 400 kilometers down from the human spaceship in its synchronous orbit about Egg. The face that lay under him on the tasting screen flickered off and was replaced with his own image.
I simply must see how gorgeous I look,
Soother's worry thought.
Those humans can just wait a while. Besides, with a computer slowing everything down by a million to one, so the slow ones can follow things, I bet they never even notice that I stopped talking.
Soother's worry absorbed his image through his tread and glowed inwardly at the sight. His dozen eyes glistened in a deep red halo about the Baroque pattern that he had recently had painted on the top side of his flattened, ellipsoidal body. He turned slowly, watching the pattern shift on the screen. The dozen shiny reflective circles near the base of each eye stub mirrored the black sky and stars, so that it looked as if he had holes through his body looking out on another universe. Winding between the circles was a stripe of highly emissive paint that glowed a hot yellow against his deep red topside surface.
Beautiful. Simply beautiful. Mother will simply love it, he gloated.
He wanted his mother to like him. She almost never visited him anymore, and seemed to spend all her time with Soother's First and Soother's Pride.
You must remember,
Soother's Worry said to himself in an imitation of the old one who had had the job of raising him.
Your mother is Soother of all clans and has more important things to do than to take care of her children.
If only,
thought Soother's Worry,
she had not commanded that her eggs be kept separate from all the others. Then I would be just another Chila from the central nursery, and not have to worry whether my mother was neglecting me or not. But,
he reminded himself,
if it had not been for Mother, I certainly would not have the enviable position of Keeper of the Calm. As boring as the job is, it is certainly one of the most prestigious in Soother's empire.
Soother of all clans paused at the entrance to the egg pen. The old one in charge of the pen, having no eggs to keep him busy, had felt her tread and was waiting for her. He watched with a combination of anxiety and eagerness as the egg sac was extruded onto the crust from Soother's laying orifice. As soon as the sac was safely on the crust, flattened into a nice ellipsoidal shape, the old one spread out one of his edges into a hatching mantle and covered the egg gently with a thin membrane. He then slowly rolled the egg toward him and placed it under the protection of his body.
This one shall be named Soother's Rock, Soother said. Its father is Yellow Rock, leader of the clan in the northwest. As soon as the eggling is ready to leave the hatchling pen, it is to be sent to Yellow Rock for rearing as a youth of its father's clan, for it will become leader when its father flows.
It will be done, Soother of all clans, the old one said.
Soother turned and rejoined her chief advisors, Soother's First and Soother's Pride, her first two children. She was getting a little tired of the constant egg-laying, but it was one of her most important duties as Soother of all clans.
"Who is the next one?"
she asked Soother's First.
"There are many choices, Mother," he said. "However, our merchant informers in the clans to the north have told us that the clan leader Deadly Sting has been talking about a formal challenge to your leadership, despite the fact that you have forbidden leadership duels. Perhaps a command to him to visit here for a formal meeting with you would awe him enough that we would get him to hold off."
"Then again," Soother's Pride said, "if he gets too difficult while he is here, we could arrange for him to flow."
"No,"
Soother remonstrated.
"I don't think that will be necessary. After all, the whole object of my reign is to soothe away these barbaric instincts in my people, so that in future generations they will act in a civilized manner, as the humans do."
"Shall it be Deadly Sting, then?" Soother's First asked.
"Yes," Soother said. We will give that near barbarian from the north a royal welcome that will make him feel much more important than he really is. Then, after the formal meeting, we will send him home with so many gifts that he will forget all about trying to challenge my rule.
I will arrange it immediately, Mother, Soothers first said, moving off toward the royal compound.
I am going to Sky Talk Library, Soother told Soother's pride. I understand that a new book about one of the early human rulers has been sent down by the humans on one of the alternate communication channels. I want to study it carefully for new ideas. I hope that the ideas on government by the human Napoleon will prove to be as interesting as those of Machiavelli were.
Soother's pride watched his mother flow off toward the Sky Talk compound, a squad of troopers automatically shaping a chevron formation about her, their burly bodies acting as pathbreakers for her in both the hard and the soft directions. As she moved off, Soother's pride heard her tread muttering as she moved.
What shall I name it? Soother's Sting? Who ever heard of a soothing sting? Soother's Deadly? No, that's worse.
As Soother approached the Sky Talk compound, she headed directly for the library and was careful to avoid the comm complex. The last thing she wanted to be bothered with was the fawning presence of Soother's worry. She was very sorry that she had studied only the government sections of the Human Encyclopedia in her youth. She had applied her new knowledge of government to the naive ruling system of the semi-barbaric Chela of her time, and had shortly taken over the leadership of the combined clans. She had forged a mighty state that had conquered the remainder of the barbarian tribes on Egg, and had finally brought peace to the entire star. As soother of all clans, she was now powerful enough to subjugate any unruly band or clan. But her job now was to consolidate her rule by less violent means and form a hereditary dynasty that would eliminate forever the problem of deciding who the next ruler would be. For that would be foreordained from birth. Her first, and she hoped her only, mistake was trying to form the line of descendants completely from her own flesh. Soothers First was a beautiful example of a Chela, and she would be proud to have him carry on her name after she flowed. She had thought that, since he was such a handsome specimen, she could combine her excellent qualities with his by mating with him as soon as he left the hatching pens. Unfortunately, the result was not what she had expected. The old ones at the hatchery tried to give the little one extra attention, but it was soon obvious to all that the hatchling was barely smart enough to feed itself. Soother had found the sinecure of keeper of the calm for Soother's worry, but the last thing she wanted was to be reminded of her own weaknesses. For, according to the Human Encyclopedia section on genetics, the weaknesses that were so obvious in Soother's worry were lying dormant in her, only they were masked by other better genes from her mates.
If only I had at least scanned the other sections instead of concentrating solely on the government section, she said to herself for what seemed to be the dozenth time, knowing full well that if she had done that, she would still be in the library and would not now be Soother of all clans. Actually, Soother had almost gotten away with her scheme. The Chela biophysicists would not determine the genetic coding mechanism for the Chela for dozens of generations, but when they did, both they and the humans would be surprised at how different it was. Because of the high temperatures on the neutron star that attempted to disrupt everything into random chaos, and the all-pervasive magnetic field that lined everything up along the magnetic field lines, the Chela genetic structure was a triply redundant linear strand of complex nuclear molecules. As the duplicating enzymes would copy the genetic molecule,
The check at each triply redundant site provided an automatically correcting copying mechanism. If one of the three linear strands had mutated, the copying enzyme would be governed by majority rule, and the new triple strand would have the mutation corrected. If two mutations had occurred, and all three sites were different, the enzyme would self-destruct, taking the faulty gene with it. It was only when the two mutations were the same that an error was able to creep through. Unfortunately, there had been too many repeated errors in those genes that had formed the nervous system in her son, Soother's worry. He was mentally retarded. Many, many eggs later, Soother was getting tired, yet her ambition drove her on. Her aging body was now pouring nucleonic hormones into her juices that were designed to make her slow down her aggressive drive and retire to the essential job of being an old one. The old ones were designed by the Chela genes to carefully tend the clan eggs that the younger females would lay and forget, while they returned to their jobs as warriors, protecting the clan from enemies. There were no real enemies anymore, and Soother did not want to be an old one tending eggs. So she transferred her developing parental instincts to the Chela as a whole and drove herself on, consolidating her rule by using the governmental techniques developed by generations of humans. Finally, Soother began to realize that she could not go on forever. Eventually, she would have to flow, and the Soother of all clans would not be there to keep the quarrelsome clans soothed. Of course, Soother's First was quite capable and willing to take her place and assume his duties as Soother of all clans. However, her personal ambition kept her from relinquishing her control over her people. Soother then remembered an old story about the Ancient One named Swift Killer, who had first made contact with the humans. The Leonardo da Vinci of the Chela, Swift Killer had invented the first communication system and was the first Keeper of the Calm. That was long ago, when the Keeper of the Calm had to know how to keep the communication and data storage systems operating and didn't have a team of communication engineers and library assistants to run things. Soother went to visit the scientists at Sky Talk Compound.
"I understand that Swift Killer, the first Keeper of the Calm, experienced a strange transformation that rejuvenated her," she said.
"Yes," the scientist replied. "Under extreme trauma, her body reverted to that of a dragon plant. She stayed that way for some dozens of grades of turns, and then, for some reason, the dragon plant reverted back to that of a Chela. However, the new body, having been almost completely rebuilt, was that of a youth, while the scarred outer skin and brain was that of an older one."
"I want to go through that transformation," Soother said, "so that I may continue to lead my people."
"That would be very dangerous, O Soother of all clans," the scientist said in alarm. Shortly after Swift Killer's experience, the experiment was tried by many Chela. With most of them, nothing happened, and they finally gave up and went off to tend eggs. With others, they had starved themselves so much that they just stopped living and flowed. There was not enough meat left on them even to bother calling the butchers. A few tried both starvation and a severe heating of the topside. Most of these died from the serious burns, and only one started the transformation. However, even that one died before he was well started. You may not have learned it in the stories that you read about Swift Killer, but she was not alone. There were two others with her, and one of those died."
"Then, if it is done properly, the odds are 2 out of 3, Soother said firmly.
"But Soother," protested the scientist, "we don't really know how to do it properly. No one was there to witness the transformation."
"Still," Soother continued, "if I do not go through the transformation, I am surely going to flow soon. I want to be transformed, and within the next great of turns. You and the others are to read all that you can and make preparations. I will return when you are ready."
"It shall be done," the scientist said with resignation. Soother flowed away from him without further word, her squad of troopers forming automatically around her as she moved off. There was really little more to learn about the ancient transformation of Swiftkiller. What records the scientists had were mostly old storyteller tales that had been distorted by many tellings before they had been written down. It was well less than a grade of turns before the scientists let Soother know that they were as ready as they could be. Soother came at once. She left Soother's pride in charge of the routine business of running the Empire, while Soother's first and a full troop of needle troopers came to Skytalk Compound to make sure that the experiment was carried out safely. When Soother's first and the troop commander heard what Soother would be subjected to, they protested strongly.
"They are going to kill you with that treatment," Soother's first warned. "First they are going to starve you until you are an empty sack, and then they are going to sear your topside with a bank of X-ray arcs," the troop commander shouted.
"Yet that is what Swiftkiller went through, and so can I," Soother said bravely. "I want you two to see that they do it properly."
"I can't see how we can protect you from them," the troop commander said. "What they propose to do to you does not sound like a treatment, but a fiendish torture for a particularly nasty barbarian."
"But you can protect me," she replied, "for if I die, you can see that they do also."
The troop commander hesitated, for to kill unarmed thinkers, who had only done their best, and, under protest, did not seem like the kind of thing a decent warrior should do. But his sense of duty overcame his principles. After all, the one giving the order was the Soother of all clans.
"It will be as you say, Soother of all clans," said the troop commander obediently.
"And if I do flow," Soother said to Soother's first, "you shall be the next Soother of all clans. Rule well, my son."
She formed a small tendril and stroked him lightly on the topside.
"I will, mother," he said.
"But don't count on it," she cut in abruptly, "for I intend to come back, younger than you."
Her tendril whipped off his topside and shrank back into her surface. She moved off toward the waiting scientists.
"You may proceed," she said.
Although Soother had not eaten for 36 turns in preparation for the ordeal, it took 24 more turns before the scientists and doctors felt that she had been weakened enough that her body functions were disrupted to the point where the plant transformation enzymes could begin to dominate the animal enzymes. They could now start the next phase of the transformation. According to the legends of the storytellers, Swiftkiller had a blotchy topside after her transformation. Some painful experiments with volunteers who had suffered a small section of their topsides to be seared with lengthening sessions under an X-ray arc had shown that the blotches were caused by blisters that formed on the skin after a certain amount of exposure to X-rays. The timing was critical, however. For too long an exposure caused the blistered surface to char, and then the burn was too severe. The volunteer who had suffered that much radiation still had a nasty scar in the small test spot. He would not have survived if the burn had been over a much larger area. Soother was barely conscious when the banks of X-ray arcs were struck. The violet-white radiation beamed unmercifully down upon her weakened body. The pain and shock knocked her out, and she flowed. The doctors were watching closely, and the arcs were extinguished just as the blister started. The troop commander and Soother's first stood by,
looking with distaste and horror on the flattened sack of blistered skin that lay in front of them. The scientists and doctors hovered around, their tendrils constantly touching the now sleeping body.
"She still lives,"
one of the doctors said,
"but her body functions are very unusual. Her fluid pumps are not beating as they do when a Chela is struck in the brain nut and knocked unconscious. Instead, they are moving very slowly. It is a state that the humans call sleep."
Soothers first moved toward the body and confirmed their diagnosis. "It is indeed fortunate for you that she is still alive," he said. "Continue your work."
"There is nothing left for us to do,"
one of the scientists said.
"It is now up to her body. All we can do is make sure that she is not disturbed. We can only wait and watch."
For 24 turns, nothing much happened, except that the blistered topside started slowly to heal itself. As the healing progressed, Soothers first noticed that the muscle tone of the skin, which had been poor at the end of the starvation period, now became almost non-existent. The skin under the healing blisters seemed to be almost transparent. Then, after another 12 turns, a small 12-pointed crown started to lift up under the center of the sack of skin.
"It looks as if the transformation is working," one of the scientists reported. "The root spike must now be complete, and that is the start of the cantilever structure that will hold the skin up to the sky."
Inside Soother, the hormones and enzymes were busy. The animal muscle was attacked and dissolved, but the enzymes were careful to take their dissolution process just so far. The string-like molecules in the muscle tissue were carefully teased apart into separate strands, but the strands were carefully maintained as long fibers. The longer they were, the stronger would be the resulting dragon crystal. The fibers floated through the juices, where they were picked up by the enzymes, building the engineering marvel that would lift the huge body up off the surface of egg against the fierce gravity, the stiff structures of the plant body being capable of doing something that the more flexible tissues of the animal body could never do. Carefully, the enzymes worked the long fibers into the crystal, embedding them firmly into the clear crystallium, to make a composite material that was many times stronger than the crystallium itself. Things went well for a while, and the cantilever structure grew, slowly lifting the thin sack of skin off the ground. However, long before the 12-pointed structure was really finished, the muscle tissue ran low. The growth slowed, and every strand that floated nearby was eagerly salvaged by the enzymes that struggled to make do with inadequate building materials. Finally, the last portions of the spikes were being made almost entirely of inadequate, clear crystallium. Soother had waited too long for her transformation. The ancient Swiftkiller had been a well-exercised troop commander, and even in her starved state, she had had plenty of muscle tissue. But Soother had been an administrator too long, and had not gone into her ordeal with sufficient reserves. Soothers first was awed by the huge plant that began to tower over him. Even the scientists were greatly pleased with the result. As the turns passed, the skin folds lifted off the crust, and the doctors could already tell from the wastes emitted from the still partially functioning animal orifices that new nourishment was being generated by the plant portion of the body. Everything looked good. Soothers first even began to think about leaving the Skytalk compound to visit with Soothers Pride to work out the details of their temporary joint rule for the next 12 greats of turns, until his mother was rejuvenated. Then it happened. The tip of one of the weakened spikes broke as it attempted to tighten the skin.
Soothers First was horrified to see a jagged point of dragon crystal sticking up out of the torn fold of skin. The skin held for a while, and the scientists attempted to build a mound up against the side of the body to support the damaged section. But before the support could be arranged, an adjoining spike gave way under the unequal tension, and in a rapid series of sharp cracks and loud crashes, the remainder of the 12-pointed skeleton broke and fell to the crust. For a few moments, they all stood in horror as the thin skin oozed the last of its juices out of jagged holes onto the crust. Then, Soothers First turned to the troop commander. "I am Soother of all clans," he said. His eyes took in the horrified group of scientists and doctors. "They failed," he said. "Do as my mother commanded." The troop commander hesitated. "But they did their best," he protested. "There must have been something wrong with Soother's body for the failure to have occurred like that. It is not proper for you to punish them."
"Do not lecture to me about what is proper, for I am Soother of all clans," he replied angrily. "Obey me at once, or you will no longer be troop commander."
The troop commander felt an angry muttering among his warriors. Although they were well-trained troopers and obedient to duty, it would take all of his prestige to get them to carry out the order. Then suddenly, the troop commander realized the strength of his position. His troopers were more loyal to him personally than to Soothers First. They would not have backed him against the legendary Soother herself, but he had no question as to their choice now.
"Who is leader of all clans, old one?" he said quietly.
And not a tread moved in the complex as the ancient challenge rang out through the crust.
"What is this nonsense?" Soothers First demanded angrily. "The leadership challenge was outlawed by Soother long ago."
His eyes swept over the large body of troopers and found a burly squad leader.
"You," he ordered, "you are now commander of this troop. Take command and take this traitor into custody."
The squad leader hesitated. Then, with the repressed violence of someone who has seen her whole clan-oriented life disrupted by Soother, who kept track of her eggs like a perverted old one, she vibrated a harsh reply back through the crust.
"I take orders from my commander, not from you, you clanless mother-lover."
The vehemence of the reply startled Soothers First. He looked through the mass of trooper eyes, looking for support, but found none. The troop commander, now confident of his backing, repeated the challenge.
"Who is leader of all clans, old one?"
Soothers First did not reply, knowing that he had no chance against this battle-hardened warrior. He attempted to flow off to the west. The troop commander watched for a moment, then accepted a dragon tooth from the nearest trooper. After a very short chase, a well-aimed thrust to the brain knot ended the short rule of Soothers First. The troop commander found a very strong popular support for his actions, and soon the much larger group of clanists had overcome the numerically smaller group of mothers, and by popular acclaim, the troop commander became the new leader of all clans. Time, 14:28 and 53 seconds GMT, Monday, 20 June, 2050. Seiko was watching the image of the decorated Chila on the screen. Soother's worry was in the midst of one of his confused sentences, when suddenly there was a large crowd of Chila surrounding him. She caught a glimpse of glittering knives of dragon crystal as the computer-fed display stopped. Almost instantly, the screen flashed on again. There was no trace of Soother's worry,
and the very plain topside of Achila again was centered on her screen, the dozen eye stubs waving smoothly as the intelligent-looking eyes stared intently at the optical pickup.
"I am Leonardo, the chief scientist of the SkyTalk Science Complex," the image said. "I have been appointed the new Keeper of the Calm by the leader of all clans."
Not a flicker of surprise crossed Seiko's stolid face. 1 minute ago, the ruler of this world had been called Soother of all clans. Now they were back to the old title of Leader. Well, they were probably going through their equivalent of the consolidation of China by Qin, or of Europe by Napoleon. And one would have to expect rapid changes for a while, until they had left their semi-barbaric state and had settled down to a method for transition of rule by peaceful means.
"Welcome, Leonardo,"
Seiko said, slightly amused. The name was probably inherited with a job as chief scientist. Right now the Chila were in awe of the accomplishments of the humans, and often took names from the encyclopedia the humans were sending down. Within half a day, they would have surpassed the humans in knowledge and technology. She doubted that she would meet any Leonardos or Einsteins on her next shift.
"We are about through with the holomim crystal GAM to GRE, and we will have to take a short break while we load in the next one,"
Seiko said. "Good," said the computer-slowed image of Leonardo. "That will give us a chance to install the new radiation-to-taste converters." Time, 20:29 and 59 seconds, GMT. Monday, 20 June, 2050. Superfluid was dejected. This turn was to have been one of the greatest moments of his career, and it had been blasted by his meeting with the Council for the Programmed Education of the Slow Ones. The Council had decided that the humans would not be told about Superfluid's new theory of gravity. Instead, the humans would have to rediscover it for themselves. Superfluid had wanted to have his new theory appreciated and used by the humans. After all, they had given so much to the Chila. Yet he recognized that the only reason that the Chila were still developing on their own was that the extensive knowledge of the humans had been transmitted down to them so slowly that the faster-thinking Chila had usually figured out things by themselves long before the detailed human explanation had finally trickled in. The Council had decreed that his new discoveries on anti-gravity would have to be sent up to the humans in a coded form. The detailed information on his theory would be in the hands of the humans, but they would not be able to read it until they knew the crypto keyword that would decipher the gibberish that they had received. The crypto keyword for the anti-gravity section was the complete non-linear formula that Superfluid had laboriously developed only after many turns of deep thought.
"It isn't fair," Superfluid thought. "Before they can find out what I did, one of the humans will have had to think the same thoughts that I did, and that person will get the credit."
Yet he knew that, although the human might receive some limited notoriety for breaking the crypto code to the anti-gravity section, it would give no real consolation to the person who, after all, had come in second best.
"They are so brave, so noble, those slow ones,"
thought Superfluid, as he approached the construction site for the anti-gravity machine. Helium-2, project manager of the negative gravity test project, watched the wrinkled figure of the elderly scientist approach. According to reports, the aged one still had enough juice left in him to take an interest in his earlier scientific exploits, even though he had served a full stint at the hatching pens. He had been expecting a wrinkled but still perky aged one. But what was coming toward him was the sorriest, most dejected Chila he had ever seen since he had been hatched. There must be something wrong. Then, as Helium-2 watched,
The Chela in the distance noticed his presence. Shivering himself all over, Superfluid suddenly changed character and moved surely toward him, even though he was partially off in the hard direction.
"I presume you are Helium too,"
the aged one said with a firm tread.
"Thank you for arranging to have me present during the demonstration."
"I knew that you would want to see it," Helium 2 said. "Please follow me." The two Chela moved in single file across the dense crystal crust of the neutron star. Helium 2 pushed hard, as if he were leaning into a heavy wind. His opalescent ellipsoidal body flattened out to force an opening between the trillion Gauss magnetic field lines. He deferentially held the gap open with a trailing cluster of reinforced manipulator arms that allowed the elder scientist to flow after him with minimum effort. They paused to look around. As they did so, they felt the magnetic field close in on them again, their bodies pinned onto the field lines like beads on a wire. "How do you like it, Superfluid?" Helium 2 asked. "Big, isn't it?"
"I don't see much of anything except those large pumps over there, and some ridges in the crust."
"We had to put most of the anti-gravity machine underground because of the high pressures. Underneath those ridges are the largest high-pressure vessels ever made by Chela. They are formed of strong pipes wrapped around and around in the shape of a ring wrapped with wire. You can see one ring under that ridge, and the top of the other ring over there. They are set up at an angle to each other, so that the place of maximum interaction is just above the surface in the middle."
"I didn't visualize anything like this when I was working on my theory,"
Superfluid said, as his dozen eyes took in the vista. "You are lucky. Very few theoretical scientists ever see their mathematical equations turned into working hardware in their lifetime, especially when the theoretical work involves such a fundamental change in our understanding of nature, such as does the superfluid Einstein theory of gravitation. Einstein himself was one of the few. He lived to see his E equals mc squared prediction bring about control of nuclear energy. Einstein was lucky, because it turned out to be easy for the humans to get a nuclear chain reaction going. They just have to bring two pieces of uranium or plutonium near each other. You are fortunate in that it is easy for us to get the very high mass densities and velocities that are needed to make the superfluid effect work."
"I wish you wouldn't use that term,"
Superfluid said.
"The correct term is the gravimotive effect. People keep referring to the effect by my name, and I appreciate the honor, but I am thinking of the poor students in the future. They are going to have a hard time remembering that the superfluid effect is the gravimotive effect and does not have anything to do with superconductivity."
The two started back toward the bunker as Superfluid went on.
"I have always been proud of the unusual name that the old ones chose for me when I was a hatchling. Like you, I was hatched during the generation when the humans were beaming down the superconductivity section of their encyclopedia. The theories of superconductivity revolutionized our understanding of the interior of our home star. It made quite an impression on everyone to learn that we are floating on a crystalline crust over a liquid core of superfluid neutrons."
"All right, the gravimotive effect," Helium 2 said. "Anyway, the gravitational engineers did a good job on the design. The anti-gravity machine is a lot more efficient and compact than I thought it would be when I took on the job of managing the design and construction contract." Helium 2 went around the bunker to the entrance in the rear. "Come inside. Then we will give the machine its first try. We will only take it to half power in this first trial. We won't try to make the gravity force go negative, but there should be plenty of interesting effects when we get to zero gravity." The project manager and the scientist went into the low bunker. They raised some of their eyes up on short conical stubs and looked out over the top. Helium-2 spent the next few moments going over the checklist with the gravitational engineers.
"It is a big moment for them, too,"
Helium-2 thought. "They have been studying and training for many turns, and this is the first time they will be able to see the theories they studied work." Everything was soon ready, and Helium-2 signaled for the power to be applied. Superfluid could feel the vibrations from the great pumps as they started to move their massive loads of ultra-dense liquid. The fluid moved around in the pipes at a constantly increasing velocity. The acceleration supplied by the pumps was so great that the velocity of the dense fluid would begin to approach the speed of light in a millisecond. However, that would be more than enough time for the fast-living Chila to carry out a leisurely experiment. Superfluid could almost visualize the Einstein gravity fields generated by the motion of the liquid, and was not surprised to see the crust in the center of the machine lift up and flow out from the center. Soon, there was a great cavity almost a centimeter deep as the Einstein fields took hold and started to nullify the neutron star's 67 billion G gravitational field.
"So far, it has all been Einstein anti-gravity fields," Helium-2 whispered to him. "Very shortly, the hyper-nonlinear portion of your theory should take over, and we should get the contraction of the Einstein fields into a region at the center."
They watched tensely as the crust started to flow back to fill in the depression, more slowly this time, while the whine of the pumps moved to higher and higher pitch. Soon, the crust was nearly what it had been before, but now, above the crust at the center of the machine, was a distortion in the atmosphere.
"Why can we see the region?"
Helium-2 asked. "It can't be a distortion in space-time caused by strong gravity fields. The gravity is less there than it is here."
"No,"
Superfluid said, odd in spite of himself.
"The explanation is much more pragmatic than that. The low gravity region is visible because it doesn't have any atmosphere. The atmosphere has all flowed to the outside edges. That is an oval-shaped chunk of outer space hanging in front of you, and what you are seeing is the difference in the index of refraction of vacuum and the atmosphere."
"Now for the fun part," Helium-2 said. "We are going to interject a small chunk of pure carbon into the zero-gravity region and see what happens." Helium-2 turned to the crew and initiated the sequence of events. Superfluid watched as a short, stubby cylinder started to rise up out of the crust, right under the distortion. He could feel powerful hydraulic pumps complaining as the top of the cylinder started to approach the edge of the oval-shaped region. "That last little bit of distance is going to take some time," Helium-2 said, as the hydraulic pumps labored under the strain. "Moving those few microns from our normal gravity to zero gravity in the gravimotive effect region is equivalent to going straight up off our neutron star into outer space. Not much distance to travel, but it takes a lot of energy. We are going to stop the cylinder just as it gets to the inner edge and fire the carbon pellet from a gun built into the piston." The vibration of the hydraulic pumps finally stabilized and began to beat with a rising whine of the anti-gravity generator pumps that kept the distortion activated. Helium-2 turned a few of his eyes toward his engineers, and his undertread rumbled an order through the crust. "Inject!" Superfluid watched as a tiny speck rose from the center of the piston and floated to the center of the distortion, brightly illuminated by lights that flooded the central region with X-rays. As he watched, the speck grew, and by the time it had reached the center and hung there,
It had grown to be almost as round as he was wide.
"Why doesn't it fall out of the zero-gravity region, as the atmosphere did?"
Superfluid asked. Helium-2 replied, "Those X-ray lights are not just for illumination. They are also coupled to a servo control system. We use X-ray pressure to keep the carbon speck centered in the zero-gravity region."
"As it gets bigger, it gets harder to see,"
Superfluid said, watching in awe and amazement as the tiny speck of degenerate crystalline carbon slowly came apart. Once the material had been released from the tremendous gravitational pressures exerted by the neutron star, the nuclear repulsive forces took over, and the nuclei moved further and further apart. Now that there was space between the nuclei, the electrons, which had been packed into a superconductive fluid coursing through the close-packed array of carbon nuclei, began to evaporate from the fluid to take up orbits around the nuclei, further isolating the nuclei from each other. Soon, the tiny speck had grown 100 times larger in each direction, while its density dropped by 1,000,000.
"I can't see it anymore,"
Superfluid said. "I can. And it's beautiful," Helium-2 said, waving one of his eyes after another. "At least with some of my eyes. I think I can fix things so we can both see it without having to move around." He went to the servo control console and talked to the engineer there. He returned. "I had the engineer set the servo control so that the crystal would rotate while staying in place." They both watched as the seemingly empty space suddenly sparkled into a brilliant flash of light, then winked off again. You wouldn't think that something with a density of only a few grams per cubic centimeter would be visible at all, much less be so brilliant, Helium-2 said.
It is because the crystal structure reflects the X-rays when the atomic planes of the crystal are at just the right angle between one of the lights and one of our eyes,
Superfluid explained.
I have been watching the pattern carefully as it rotates. If I am not mistaken, that is a crystal with a cubic lattice structure. What did you say the seed material was?
Carbon, Helium-2 said.
I think that is what the humans call a diamond,
Superfluid said.
They were right. It is pretty.
Time, 20:30, exactly, GMT. Monday, 20 June, 2050. The chimes rang again and again, insistently. Pierre woke up grudgingly, his red-lined eyes peering at the numbers on the clock. 20:30, the numbers indicated.
I missed my shift,
Pierre exclaimed, slapping the release and running an index finger down the ceiling seam of the sleeping sack. As his brain became more active, he realized that shifts no longer counted, but he still should be awake and helping.
6 hours, he groaned as he rubbed his face. 6 hours, and 3/4 of a millennium. I wonder what is going on.
He quickly bathed and, still holding a food stick, swung up the passageway to the back of the communications console. Abdul looked up as he came in.
Glad to see you, Pierre, he said in a concerned voice. Did you get some sleep?
Yes, Pierre replied. Enough to keep me awake for the rest of my shift.
Thanks for standing in for me.
No problem, Abdul said. It has been interesting watching the Chila civilization develop almost right in front of my eyes.
At what stage are the Chila now?
Pierre asked.
They are beginning to pass us in all areas except molecular chemistry. But since they don't even have molecules to experiment on, you can't blame them for that. They tell us that they can almost predict the contents of the rest of the encyclopedia, but they insist that we send the entire text down for the sake of their historians and humanologists.
We should be changing to the last encyclopedia crystal, WAT2ZYZ, shortly. Then, you should erase the encyclopedia crystals, and the Chilo will start filling them up with information that they have learned on their own in the past day.
Good, Pierre said. Amalita and I can take it from here. You had better get some rest yourself.
I won't take long, Abdul said as he floated out the door. This is too interesting to miss.
Time, 22:26 and 3 seconds, GMT. Monday, 20 June, 2050. Floating Crystal returned from her vacation with mixed emotions. It had been a delightful vacation. 8 long turns in the foothills at Swift's Climb Mountain Resort. She had enjoyed every millisecond of it, even though she would never get used to the idea of looking down on things. She was reluctant to return to what everyone would admit was often the most boring job on the star. Yet, at the same time, she felt eager to be back at work. While the job of Keeper of the Calm was boring at times, it was the most important position a Chila could aspire to, with the possible exception of the President of the United Clans. Floating Crystal was feeling good as she entered Skytalk Complex. She decided to take a shortcut. Rather than moving along the paths in the easy direction and then crossing over at the superconducting tunnels, she flattened herself out and pushed her way in the hard direction across the park that separated the compounds and the complex. She could almost feel the magnetic field lines rippling across her topside as she pushed herself along, her tread gripping the textured surface. She flowed by the crumbling ruins of the gigabit receiving antenna that had been the pride and joy of her predecessors many generations ago, and went into the compound surrounding the huge transmitter array. Her first thought was to check on the comm display. As she flowed onto its large, flat surface, she could tell that the human, Amalita Shakashiri Drake, was still in the middle of her sentence. At the bottom of the screen, the computer had superimposed the words of the sentence. Those that Amalita had already spoken were in one taste, and the computer prediction for the words in the rest of the sentence were in another taste. It was a long sentence, and full of the many redundancies that the humans found necessary to insert into their speech. It was the very predictability of the redundancies that made the job of Keeper of the Calm so boring. Before Floating Crystal had left on her vacation, Amalita had spoken the words,
"Pierre has informed me that the whole..."
Floating Crystal did not need a computer to figure out that the next few phonemes were "lo mem crystal," and that the rest of the sentence was probably something about the holographic memory data storage crystal being full, and that they should stop transmitting data up for a minute while Pierre put in a blank crystal. When Amalita had gotten to Hollow, Floating Crystal had decided it would be a good time for a long vacation, and had taken off. On her return to the display, she was surprised to find that both she and the computer had misjudged the human. Amalita had progressed much further in her sentence than she had expected, although the general content was the same. The computer display of the spoken part now read, "Pierre has informed me that the holomem's full. Stop 1 minute."
"Good," Floating Crystal thought to herself. "The old array has been transmitting data up to the humans for generations. That minute will give us time to tear down the obsolete hunk of junk